Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Syria, where street battles are underway in Damascus, indicating the fall of the Assad regime might happen sooner than expected. Rafif Shujati joins us from Cairo. She is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian local coordinating committees inside Syria, and we will discuss claims that the Assad regime has already used chemical weapons against the opposition and look into whether Syria's WMD arsenals might end up with Iran or Hezbollah. Then we'll examine a report by the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations released Monday about the extent to which the global British bank HSBC has been engaged in laundering money for Mexican drug cartels, dealt with Iran, Syria, and Cuba, and is doing business with a Saudi bank that was an early benefactor of Al-Qaeda. Former banking investigator William K. Black, the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, joins us. Then finally, we'll speak with Thomas Ferguson, who has been investigating the deletion of key files at the Federal Election Commission, documenting so-called dark money contributions from some of Romney's biggest donors, such as the Swift boater Harold Simmons. Tom Ferguson has an article at Alternet revealed key files on big-ticket political donations vanish at Federal Election Commission. Joining us now from Cairo, Egypt, is Rafif Shujati, the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordinating Committee inside of Syria. Rafif helps organize protests, workshops, and other events designed to empower other activists to take action and inform the world public about events inside Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rafif Shujati.
Thank you.
So what are you doing in Cairo, Egypt, Rafif? Is there support for the Syrian opposition? I imagine there is, right?
Well, specifically, I am in Cairo helping to put on a workshop for nonviolent tactics in the Syrian opposition. And as we've spent time in Cairo, we've noticed overwhelming support from just about every person we've talked to.
At this point in Syria, it does seem, with battles going on in Damascus itself, roadblocks being set up by the Syrian opposition between the city and the airport, many people are starting to see this as the beginning of the end, if you will, for the Assad regime. The Iraqi government has called upon its citizens to leave Syria. How close do you think this is? I mean, obviously, the Assad family still have enormous military assets at their disposal, and the opposition is divided and lightly armed.
Well, so I don't know how close the regime is to full collapse, but what we do know is that if the fight is now in central Damascus, and it is, we know that the regime is going to have to divert its forces from other cities and towns to, in a sense, defend Damascus. So we know that it will most likely heat up in Damascus if the fighting is taking place at the heart of the city. It can't be much longer for the Assad regime. We also have the significant high-level defections of ambassadors now. And, of course, Manaf Plus, the brigadier general, who also happens to be a childhood friend of Bashar Assad. So these new developments are extremely significant. And I think we feel optimistic that the collapse of the regime is being expedited.
Well, apparently, according to Israeli military sources, the Syrian army on the Golan Heights is being withdrawn and redeployed, presumably to Damascus. Apparently, when Vladimir Putin was recently in Jerusalem, he was asked to lean on Assad to secure the chemical weapons arsenal that the Assad's control. And also the Syrian diplomat, Nawaf Faris, who defected from Iraq, he has gone public saying that he thinks that the President Bashar al-Assad would not shy away from using chemical weapons on his own people. He also charged that the Assads had colluded with al-Qaeda in carrying out attacks on American soldiers and personnel in Iraq during the Iraq War. So let's start with the chemical weapons scenario. What's your understanding of the size of that arsenal, and what does the Syrian opposition feel about the possibility of being used against them, or conversely, capturing it?
So the activists have been saying for a couple of months now that there is evidence of chemical weapons use in the different towns and villages that have come under military assault. We've had situations in Zabadani, in the Damascus suburbs, and we've had situations in Homs where people have been treated for skin rashes and other ailments most closely associated with different types of chemical warfare. We do know that Syria has stockpiled one of the greatest quantities of chemical weapons. And just earlier today, I was reading reports that in a couple of different cities, helicopter gunships were actually releasing a red substance and dropping it on the residents. So we think that the Assad regime is in fact using some type of chemical weapon against civilians. Moreover, I don't think we should put it past the Assad regime to use chemical weapons. They have violated every other standard of decency or of human behavior, so there's no reason to think they would shy away from further destruction.
So
in terms of the forces moving from the Golan Heights, that is correct, and goes to prove that Assad, who has long been the champion of resistance to Israel, is really focusing his military might against his civilian population.
So tell me about, again, I'm speaking with Rafif Shujati, who is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees in Syria, where she helps organize protests, workshops, and other events designed to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. In terms of your work with Egyptian activists, what is the understanding in Egypt and, by extension, Syria? My understanding is that a lot of the belief systems of the opposition in both Syria and in Egypt are based upon conspiracy theories, if you will. In Egypt, a lot of the secularists and the left who brought about the revolution, who've essentially lost out to the Muslim Brotherhood, believe that somehow the United States wanted the Muslim Brotherhood in power, which seems far-fetched. And then on the other hand, in Syria, I was just talking to the Amnesty International monitor who snuck into Syria and witnessed massacres there and documented them for Amnesty International. She said that lots of people inside Syria say that somehow the Bush administration and the Americans deliberately took down the Iraq regime because they want to empower the Iranians and the Hezbollah and the Assad Alawite regime. Is that true, that these are common belief systems?
I don't think so. I don't subscribe to conspiracy theories like that, and I certainly can't speak to what the Bush administration intended to do in Iraq. I believe many of the Egyptian activists feel that their revolution was stolen from them by political parties with other agendas. Now, in Syria, certainly there are competing political agendas, and the country is rapidly descending into chaos. I believe that chaos has been perpetrated by the Assad regime because it knew very well that there would be groups willing to capitalize on the chaos. The regime is sowing sectarian strife. It has allowed its borders to be very, very porous and allow in different types of groups. What I can tell you is that the Syrian activists are standing for democracy and freedom and dignity. They're looking to organize themselves in local councils. They're looking to implement democratic processes as much as they can. Now, as the conflict gets increasingly militarized, and as the international community continues to meet and discuss the Syrian situation, there's no doubt that other nations' regional and strategic interests are coming into play. But I do not believe that the United States has an interest in propping up the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, and I do not believe that the majority of the Syrian population would ever want the Muslim Brotherhood to be the reigning government.
So what do you think then there are two realities here, I guess, Rafif Shujati, what's happening on the ground? And, you know, the Red Cross have just come out and said that it's a civil war, which could invoke humanitarian actions and lawsuits and criminal prosecution later. In fact, the British foreign minister, speaking at a refugee camp in Jordan today, warned the Syrian regime that they might face the International Criminal Court But what's your sense then of the two realities, what's happening on the ground, particularly with battles now in Damascus, and what's not happening at the UN? Because they've apparently postponed the meeting that was supposed to take place at the Security Council to push Russia and China away from their support of Assad.
I think there's a huge discrepancy between what is happening on the ground and what the international community is doing or how it's reacting to the tragedy that is now Syria. On the one hand, in Syria, of course, there's an armed conflict in that the FSA is shoring up its strength and taking on the Assad regime. In response, the Assad regime is using helicopter gunships and missiles and mortars and very sophisticated weaponry that's provided by the Russians. So this is on the one hand. On the other hand, the international community has launched multiple condemnations and urgent communiques asking Bashar Assad to stop the killing. Of course, he has not responded, nor does he actually care. I mean, he doesn't even consider these appeals. The international community postponing a UN Security Council decision is simply postponing this conflict. And what they're failing to understand is the extent of the humanitarian disaster that is taking place in Syria. We have now close to 2 million internally displaced people. We have more than 16,000 dead. We have more than 200,000 people who are in prison and being tortured. So the international community needs to quit postponing and take some significant action. If we can invoke Chapter 7 and place specific sanctions against the Assad regime, that would be an extremely positive step.
Well, in my conversations recently with the Amnesty International official who went into Syria risking her life to document massacres in 23 villages following the Syrian army, she spoke to people who had been imprisoned in jail cells that were 4 by 5 meters that contained 120 prisoners jammed in, and that they would take them out routinely and torture them. And many didn't come back. They simply died under torture. And those that came back from torture said that they would rather die than go back and be tortured. So this is the MO of this regime. They've been doing this from day one. So I don't understand why the international community doesn't, why they stick to the figure of 16,000 dead. If you've got 50,000 missing and at least 100,000 in prison, and if they routinely torture and kill people in prison, wouldn't the death toll be at least up to 100,000 by now?
Well, the death toll conceivably could have surpassed 100,000. We only report what we've been able to verify and document. And you have to understand that the verification and documentation process in itself is an extremely dangerous mission, because anybody caught doing that verification is arrested and then tortured and presumably dies under torture. In fact, we have lost a great many activists simply because they were documenting or filming or verifying information. So in reality, we will probably never know the true death toll of this Syrian revolution. What we can do is communicate as much as we can, as often as we can.
Again, I'm speaking with Rafif Joujadeh, who is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees in Syria, and we're talking about the latest fighting that's going on inside of the capital, Damascus itself, and the extent to which the Assad regime, according to a lot of people, including Secretary of State Clinton, are in their last throes. But there's a great deal of concern, obviously, about what happens to the arsenals, particularly Syria's vast chemical arsenal, which is rumored to be one of the biggest in the world. And they also have biological weapons as well, apparently. You've told us that already the chemical arsenal of the Assads is being used against the Syrian opposition. And that is in itself so appalling, it's hard to get your head around. But what about the possibility, as some people have expressed concern, that both Iran and Hezbollah, who are allies with the Assad regime, may end up inheriting these arsenals?
Oh, I think that's a fear and should be taken seriously. Again, we come to the international community to see what it is prepared to do to, A, stop the civilian casualties, B, address the humanitarian situation, and perhaps most importantly, make sure that that arsenal of chemical weapons does not fall into the wrong hands.
So do you think that Russia can, I mean, I mentioned earlier, Rafif, that Shimon Peres, the Israeli president, when he was in discussion with Putin recently, urged Putin to urge the Assads to secure the chemical arsenals. I'm not sure that Assad's even listening to Putin anymore, is he? And one of the unfortunate things about Putin, from my Russian sources, tell me that he honestly believes that the opposition in Russia against him is being fermented and being organized and paid for by the CIA. And he is in many ways sympathetic to Assad's similarly ludicrous notion that the Syrian opposition are paid agents of foreign powers. I mean, it just boggles the mind, the idea that you could pay people to stand up in the middle of the street and face snipers and tanks. I just can't believe that you could actually pay people to risk their lives like the Syrian opposition is doing.
Well, certainly failed dictators are always going to jump on the conspiracy theory and discuss paid armed gangs from the West who are there to spread chaos. This is an old story and really comes right out of the dictator's manual. So it's an old story. We're all familiar with it. So no, I don't believe people are being paid to, as you said, face snipers, have their towns and villages blown up. We have entire villages that have been eradicated in Syria. Nobody's being paid to do that. Whether or not Putin can pressure Assad would really depend on whether or not Assad is in any sort of rational frame of mind. And as he once said, any government that fires on its own people is led by a crazy person. So we have an admission of insanity. We see completely irrational behavior. We see, in fact, suicidal behavior. We see a regime that is prepared to stop at absolutely nothing to crush a popular revolution that has grown steadily day by day and month after month.
So the figures on the number of defections of Syrian soldiers from the Syrian army are up to 13,000 have defected to the Free Syrian Army, and that includes 60 to 70 senior officers. Is that your understanding?
Oh, I think the number is actually higher than that.
So this is a good percentage.
We have estimates of some 40,000 soldiers who have defected publicly. We have estimates of several thousand other soldiers who, in fact, have defected but have not announced their defections, and, in fact, they're helping the opposition. There are still tens of thousands of soldiers who have been restricted to their barracks because of the fear of defection. So in essence, the operating forces of the Assad regime are gradually diminishing.
So, Rafif, since you're in Cairo, Egypt, what's your sense of this big, important Arab country weighing in? It's sort of been on the sidelines. I mean, the Saudis and the Qataris have been leading the opposition and funding it, as much as I know, and to some extent Turkey has been cooperating. The U.S. seems to be staying out of it. Israel seems to be staying out of it. What's the likelihood of the new Egyptian government weighing in on this catastrophe in Syria?
From what I can tell during my brief time in Cairo, Egypt has its own problems that it needs to address, and I think they will probably stay busy with their own affairs. They should stay busy with their own affairs for the time being. And I think any pressure they exert should be through the form of the Arab League, which seems to be more or less united in the call for Assad to step down.
Well, just in closing, Rafif Shujati, do you think it will take then for, if the United Nations is paralyzed and if China and Russia, for their own reasons, don't want to exert their influence, and we may well be exaggerating how much influence they have over this delusional family that's been in control of Syria for so long and simply believes that that's their destiny and can't accept the idea that their own people want them out. What's your sense of what it will take? Is there anything that American citizens can do, people that may be listening to this program?
Oh, U.S. citizens certainly can pressure their own representatives to, in turn, pressure the administration to take more action. Certainly they can donate to the various relief efforts underway to alleviate some of the human suffering that's taking place. But I think now that the conflict has reached Damascus, it looks like with increasing defections, both military and diplomatic, it sounds like the Assad regime is going to collapse very, very soon. We understand that the economic sanctions that are in place are beginning to take good effect. And so it's quite possible that we won't need the international community to step in to remove Bashar al-Assad. It looks like the Syrian people will be able to do it themselves. What we will need is post-Assad support as we rebuild the country. As you know, the regime has shelled huge amounts of land. They have set fire to agricultural land. They have annihilated some villages, and most of the major cities are in various stages of complete destruction. So we're going to need to rebuild the country from the ground up, and I think that is where perhaps the international community can be effective in helping us to rebuild civil society and infrastructure.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today from Cairo, Egypt.
Thank you.
Rafif Shujaati. Again, I've been speaking with Rafif Shujaati, who is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees inside Syria. She helps organize protests, workshops, and other events designed to empower other activists to take actions and to inform the world public about events in Syria. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment talking about the Senate investigation into the British bank HSBC. I'm gonna go up there.